The Irish Independent reports in its lead story that tough COVID-19 restrictions are likely to remain until some time in June. The Deputy Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Ronan Glynn, is quoted as saying that people should expect to be working from home full time for the next 3 or 4 months. The plan is to proceed very cautiously on the basis of the data in front of us for as long as it takes, he said. Bed down until June, says the Irish Daily Mail headline, over a report that Dr. Glynn signalled little change on the 5th of April. Ministers are split on easing the 5-kilometre travel restriction next month, according to the Irish Times. The paper says that public health chiefs have indicated that advice against non-essential overseas travel and for working from home will remain until the end of June. The Irish Examiner highlights the statement by the Health Service Executive that it will be a period of days before the AstraZeneca vaccine will be given to the public here. Now that the European Medicines Agency confirmed that this vaccine is not associated with an increase in the overall risk of blood clots in those who receive it, other European countries will start administering AstraZeneca from today, the paper says. The Northern Ireland Health Minister Robin Swan has moved to reassure the public following news of a delay in delivery of AstraZeneca, which is likely to affect supplies, the Irish News reports. He said that all adults in the north are still expected to be offered their first COVID vaccine by the end of July. The race meeting at Cheltenham provides the main story for two papers. The Irish Sun reports on Paul Dean, a canny punter as it calls him, who cashed out his €5 five-leg accumulator for €300,000 after the first four nags romped home. He breathed a sigh of relief when his last horse fell, the paper says. Wonder Woman is the Irish Daily Mirror's headline. That's the jockey Rachel Blackmore, who the paper says is just one race away from Cheltenham domination. She is tipped to become the first female rider to win the Gold Cup and the first woman to scoop the Cheltenham Top Jockey Award, says the Mirror. The Star, in its lead story, reports that Joe O'Reilly, who is serving a prison sentence for the murder of his wife Rachel Callaly in 2004, has adopted a vegan diet. In other stories, The Times reports that Mary McAleese, former president, has criticised Pope Francis as a populist who raises expectations only to dash them. This follows the publication on Monday of a Vatican document which sustained a ban on same-sex blessings. Mrs. McAleese described the document, approved by the Pope, as withering. As The Independent notes, she challenged Irish bishops to acknowledge that the language used was gratuitously cruel in the extreme.
And we heard words like caution, plateauing and static used by Neffet yesterday to describe Ireland's current position in the fight against COVID. Since late February, we're moving more, we're congregating more, and there are rising numbers returning to the workplace. No further COVID-19 related deaths were reported, but there were still 582 new positive cases yesterday. The Deputy Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Ronan Glynn, said he's less concerned about the day-to-day COVID trends and narratives. He said people should instead focus on the bigger picture when it comes to the vaccine and the easing of restrictions.
I'd ask people to focus on the fact that, all going well, 8 out of 10 adults in this country will have at least one dose of vaccine available to them by the end of June. And to my mind, that's what we need to be focusing on over the next couple of months. It's really difficult for people. I know people are absolutely exhausted, but the vaccine is coming. We'll see a very, very significant increase in the number of people getting doses of vaccine through April, further increases through May, and widespread rollout through May and June. And we just need to get there without allowing another wave. We're seeing what's happening all across Europe. We just cannot stand over a situation where people who will be vaccinated and will be protected are allowed to get infected over the next, what are, a short number of weeks, in the context of everything we've gone through over the past year.
Dr. Ronan Glynn at yesterday's NPHET briefing. Let's talk to Monaghan-based GP Dr. Ilona Duffy. Good morning.
Morning, Mary.
And Dr. Lynn, they're focusing on the end of June when he says 80% will have received at least a first dose of vaccination. But how is your vaccine rollout going? You've been concentrating, as have other GPs, on the vaccination of the over 85s and the over 80s. Some difficulties reported in the early part of the rollout with the distribution of the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. Has that been sorted?
Well, I think you're right. There have been difficulties since the beginning of this, which is over a month at this stage. There are continued difficulties for some practices, and a lot of that is outside the hands of the HSC because it is all about the delivery of the vaccines into our country initially. So we are aware that GPs throughout the country are planning clinics but are now getting phone calls to say, look, you're not going to get the full amount for the cohort of patients that you're doing, so you need to kind of readjust your clinics and readjust those patients that you've booked in. I think communication has improved in that we're now getting phone calls a bit earlier. We had been getting phone calls a day to 2 days before a planned clinic or a planned delivery of vaccines. Now at least we're guaranteed that we will get a phone call a week in advance to tell us how many vaccines we're going to get. So it continues to be slow for many practices. Some practices have been lucky and have managed to vaccinate most of their over 70 group of patients, but practices like our own still have only managed to do those who are over 85. But in our case, we've been promised a delivery of Moderna vaccines next Monday, and we hope to be able to start moving down to our over 80s. So I think the big problem is the continued delivery of vaccines to the country, and that continues to be slow.
And while you await those deliveries, what are you hearing from your patients? At the moment, it's the Moderna vaccine that you will be giving to people. But are you getting concerns about the speed of that and also worries about what's to come with AstraZeneca?
Absolutely. We're fielding a lot of calls in the practice. Number one, those who are frustrated that they haven't heard from us with regards to booking either themselves or their family member in for the vaccine. We're getting phone calls from patients who are deemed very high risk and are aware that they should be getting a call from the hospital setting to book in. Some of them had got those calls and were planned to be vaccinated this week, and unfortunately because of the temporary withdrawal of the AstraZeneca vaccine, then that was cancelled. And the third group we were getting calls were from those mainly actually healthcare workers who'd received one dose of the AstraZeneca, and as you're aware there's a 12-week gap, so they're wondering, was it safe for them to get the second dose? So I suppose working backwards from that, it's very reassuring to have seen the EMA's approval of AstraZeneca and their reassurance that there is no increased risk of clot associated with it and that the benefits far outweigh any potential risks that there are. So I think that hopefully will give us the confidence to move ahead and continue with our community vaccination using the AstraZeneca vaccine and reassure those who have concern that it is a safe vaccine, it is an effective vaccine, and that they should go ahead and take it when they're offered it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, that you will be trying to reassure them and give them the statistics and the information that's available. But are you still seeing some vaccine hesitancy? Perhaps people worry that they may have a history of blood clots or stroke in their families, or worries about pre-existing conditions.
Absolutely we are, but I think it's good when you get strong advice and strong guidance from a body like the EMA, who have reviewed all the data and have been able to look back at the millions of AstraZeneca vaccine that have been given and review any potential risks associated or side effects associated with it. So when you see strong guidance like that come, I think it gives us as medics confidence to be able to be strongly guiding our patients that they should take this vaccine. And I think the reality of it is that most people want the vaccine because they want to see that there's some view of getting back to normal life, and I think that's giving them hope. I think, as Ronan Glynn has said, we've got to be careful because sometimes when we start seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, it's easy to become lax with regards to all the rest of the guidelines. And as public health guidance gave us yesterday with the stories of people going to funerals or having family gatherings, how easy it still is for this virus to transmit through.
Indeed, and let's stay with that light at the end of the tunnel. I think I saw a tweet from you in the last maybe week or 10 days where you'd had a period where you hadn't had to send any patients for COVID tests.
Mary,
has that held up?
Monaghan, as you know, had one of the highest rates of COVID infection for a couple of months after Christmas. So So it's been great in our practice to actually see the dramatic drop in both positive results and those that we're having to refer. Our numbers remain very low. We're still having the odd positive case, but it's great to see, and that is because people are adhering to the guidance. And it's great to see because it means that the lower the community transmission, the lower the chance of you becoming infected, and that we will see this hopefully spread throughout the country.
And is there a bounce for you in Monaghan from having a high vaccination rate across the border?
We'd have to hope that there is, but I think also that really people have been good with regards to the travel, and I think Garda Síochána have made their presence well known all over the country and especially here too. So we are seeing reduced travelling outside the 5 kilometres, and I think that probably has also helped. But definitely we always felt that the high rates of COVID infection across the border definitely was causing some seepage into Louth, Monaghan and Donegal, and all those counties. Well, definitely Donegal and Monaghan have dropped dramatically.
Okay, Dr. Ilona Duffy in Monaghan, thank you very much.
And we've been hearing about vaccine delays and vaccine demand across Europe this week, but even as the EU rollout lags the US and the UK, COVID-19 infection rates are rising sharply in many countries as the more contagious B117 variant takes hold. Our Europe editor Tony Connolly can talk to us now about what's going on in other member states. And Tony, the overview across Europe, would it be fair to say the struggle to control this B117 variant is failing in many states?
It's certainly taking hold in many states, Sonia, and we're seeing rising caseloads in France and Germany and Poland, Italy as well. And I should say at the outset, as a result of that decision yesterday by the EMA to say that the AstraZeneca vaccine is safe and effective, Germany, France and Italy are immediately resuming vaccinations using the AstraZeneca doses. Spain will resume next week. Sweden as well. Denmark is taking a little bit longer. But I think there is a real concern now that these rollouts can be accelerated because of the new variant, the UK B117 variant, that is causing problems. Now, France is to the fore. The government there has announced a one-month lockdown in Paris because of the huge numbers and the complete capacity of the intensive care sector in Paris is now full. 30,000 new cases a day in France, that's up 20%. So the government had a very hard lockdown a year ago and another lockdown in October. And Emmanuel Macron, the president, had been trying to delay a third lockdown since January, but he's effectively yielded to the numbers, although this is not a nationwide lockdown. This is mainly Paris, around Calais and Dunkirk, and around Nice.
Yes, and the president had been saying, hadn't he, that one of the reasons he'd been trying to avoid the lockdowns, particularly for the capital, Paris, was because it's harder for people in cities who are, you know, living in apartments more than people who've access to the countryside.
That's right. And of course, there is a political context here because he is facing election next year. So he's trying to manage these lockdowns very carefully. It should be noted that schools will remain open in Paris. People can travel up to 10 kilometres for exercise, but non-essential shops are closing, and that'll be the case in those other regions that I mentioned. Germany as well, real concern there at the UK variant B117 taking hold, a big increase in numbers. There's concern about a third lockdown in Germany, and the authorities there are starting to get concerned about death loads. The number of cases increased by 17,000 on Thursday. That's the biggest daily increase since the 22nd of January. So concerns there that Germany is going to enter another wave as this new variant takes hold.
Yes, and again, it's the same in so many other countries. Poland having problems as well. And Italy, of course, we all remember those scenes of the trucks coming in to take the coffins away. There were so many casualties a year ago when this first wave hit Europe. They've now hit more than 100,000 dead. So, it you know, a lot of bad news there, Tony.
Yeah, that's right. Italy had been operating on red and orange zones across the various regions, but more and more of those regions have now become red zones. So again, this is down to the new variants, and the government there is now starting to restrict movement between those regions, and obviously movement out and in out of and into Italy. Poland, again, 27,000 cases yesterday, new cases yesterday. That's almost double the caseload of last week, and real concerns in Poland that the health service there is really suffering under these numbers. And again, people are looking at the effect of the new variants and waiting for vaccinations to become a lot more prevalent.
And of course, we've seen the impact of a year of restrictions on the work of the Commission and the Council and the Parliament. How's Belgium doing?
Belgium's kind of had an ongoing lockdown since November. It has really pulled back any activity in the hospitality sector. Bars, cafes, restaurants have all been closed since November. There was no relaxation of that over Christmas. And so the numbers here have been kind of manageable. Notable that Belgium didn't suspend the AstraZeneca vaccine because of those health concerns over blood clots. And while the vaccination rollout has been slow in Belgium, like in other countries, it is starting to pick up. And they're hoping, again, like everybody else, that they could start hitting the 70% of adults target by sometime in the summer.
And Ireland, I mean, we're doing relatively better at the moment, aren't we, compared to many European countries? But I suppose our experience of this B117 wave, which has been with us since Christmas, it's very hard to get the numbers down. And we're looking at a lot of restrictions until vaccinations have an impact. That's a tough message, isn't it, for Europe that had been hoping for a reopening this summer, and where there have been problems so far with the rollout of the vaccine.
Yes, I mean, I think it was certainly noticed in Europe that Ireland in January and just after Christmas had that huge spike in cases, and that was in part due to the new variant. And certainly Micheál Martin, when he was at one of the video conferences with other EU leaders, was outlining the impact of the variant and the steps Ireland had to take. And I think we are now seeing a replica of that across Germany, France, other countries as that variant takes hold. I mean, it is a lot more transmissible and more dangerous. So that is why there is real concern now that the vaccination rollout intensifies. The figures that the Commission has published in this week seem to suggest that the second quarter will be a lot more bountiful for the across the board Moderna, all right, Pfizer, BioNTech and Johnson & Johnson. So that's where their hope lies.
Europe editor Tony Connolly, thank you for that and for ending on a note of hope.
Now to Ethiopia, and 2 years after winning the Nobel Peace Prize, the country's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is embroiled in a conflict in the northern Tigray region that's thrown the country into conflict. Thousands have been displaced, with hundreds more reported to have died amid claims of ethnic cleansing and human rights abuses in the region. Kate Nolan is an emergency coordinator with MSF. She returned to Limerick from Tigray last weekend. And Kate, good morning. And
good morning.
Hello, Kate, you can hear me. While the world has been focused elsewhere, it's been focused on COVID-19, and the Ethiopian government imposed a communications blackout. What has been happening in Tigray? What did you witness?
So, as you mentioned, hundreds of thousands of people have been forced to leave their homes in Tigray since the fighting broke out in early November of last year. To date, more than 60,000 people have crossed the border into Sudan as refugees. Many others are displaced within the region, staying in towns, remote areas, or trapped between localised outbreaks of fighting. For the areas that MSF teams could assess, tens of thousands of displaced people are living in abandoned buildings or on construction sites in northwestern and western areas around Shire, while others have found refuge in host communities in the east and southern parts of the region.
There were vivid reports last night. I'm sorry, Kate. There were vivid reports last night on Channel 4 News, which you may have seen, of rape being used here as a weapon of war, of Eritrean forces who are allied to government forces going systematically house to house, executing men and boys, and even Secretary of State in the United States talking about acts of ethnic cleansing. Did you see and hear of those reports while you were there?
Our teams have been providing medical and psychosocial care to survivors of sexual violence in our projects across Tigray. We know that many women still do not seek support, either because it's hard for them to reach health facilities or because of stigma. So at the moment, we still don't have a full picture on the extent and the severity of sexual violence in Tigray region. But what we have directly observed is the scale of deliberate destruction and looting of health facilities, which has been routinely witnessed by our teams across the region.
Why has that happened, Kate? And I know that your organisation, MSF, has been reporting up to 70% of the health facilities in the region being destroyed and looted, and medical supplies being destroyed.
Most of the health facilities that we have assessed looked as though they had been deliberately vandalised to make them dysfunctional. For example, we have seen in many places that windows have been broken, drugs and patient files were scattered on the floor. In many places, we saw a pattern that whatever couldn't be carried away, such as heavy equipment, was destroyed so that it could no longer be used. So it seems as though the goal was really to make the facilities unusable for the local population.
Kate, thank you very much for joining us with just that brief picture of what is happening in Tigray in Ethiopia. Kate Nolan there from MSF.
NatWest is to buy back £1.1 billion worth of shares from the UK government. The deal for almost 591 million shares in the banking group is set to complete at the start of next week. It'll bring the UK government's shareholding in the banking group to just under 59.8%. Last month, NatWest announced the phased withdrawal of Ulster Bank from the Republic of Ireland. The owner of Aer Lingus has increased the amount of money it plans to raise through bond sales following higher than expected interest from the markets. IAG now plans to raise €1.2 billion through two bond sales, as opposed to the €1 billion it announced yesterday morning. The bonds will mature in 2025 and 2029 and will have an interest rate of 2.75% and 3.75% respectively. And the Nikkei in Tokyo has fallen overnight after the Bank of Japan tweaked its monetary easing policy. The central bank there has removed the requirement to buy a minimum amount of bonds each month and said it would now focus purchases on funds listed on the TOPIX index only. That saw the Nikkei close 1.4% lower this morning. Finally, for now, the currencies: €1 buying you $1 and 19.2 cents and 85.5 pence sterling.
Wonder Woman Des Cahill, they're calling her in the Mirror today. There's no pressure, as they're all asking, can Rachel Blackmore do the double?
Well, she's Wonder Woman is a fair enough tribute to her. The latest scoreline as it stands, Mary: Rachel Blackmore 5, Great Britain 4. That's the number of winners each of them has had at Cheltenham this week. It's an incredible statistic. And despite all of the wonderful Irish wins yesterday, and there were six more, the big story is summed up in those two words: Rachel Blackmore. She's the leading jockey at the festival after wins yesterday on Alaho and Tell Me Something Girl. 5 wins for her. And it's just a remarkable achievement. It really is, in amongst the men. She doesn't come from a racing background. It's a tremendous story. She's a fabulous young woman as well. She's a lovely person. So I'd be thrilled for her if she continues and makes the leading jockey at the festival today. It's the final day, of course. Yesterday, Flooring Porter, trained by Gavin Cromwell, won the feature, the Stayers Hurdle, in the hands of jockey Danny Mullins, who only got the ride because the original jockey Johnny Moore was injured. And Johnny generously suggested that he should step down and get Danny Mullins in instead. We'll be going live to Cheltenham later in the programme to discuss Rachel's prospects of finishing as leading jockey. And Keane McCormack will be visiting her home village of Killinall. So lots more on that in the programme. And Rupert Bell joining us as well. Now, this afternoon, Willie Mullins' album photo will be seeking to make it 3 gold cups. That also would be a remarkable achievement. The big race is off at 3:05. There's also racing in Dundalk this evening. Now, there was lots of drama in the Europa League football last night. Manchester United reached the quarterfinals after a brilliantly taken goal by Paul Pogba, earned them a 1-0 win at AC Milan to secure a 2-1 aggregate victory in their last 16 tie. Arsenal stumbled into the quarter-final. They had a 1-0 defeat at home to Olympiacos, but they win 3-2 on aggregate. Pressure grows on Jose Mourinho. Tottenham were knocked out following a 3-0 loss to Dinamo Zagreb after extra time. Spurs going out 3-2 on aggregate. And following the defeat of their neighbours Arsenal on Sunday, the Tottenham captain Hugo Lloris didn't hold back on his teammates afterwards.
I think we are all more than disappointed. It's just a disgrace. I just hope everyone in the changing room feel responsible of the situation, because it's a disgrace. Now, what can I say more about it? Talking about the game of Sunday, I think it's not the right moment. The taste of the defeat tonight is just more than painful, and we are all responsible of that.
Strong stuff. Now, Rangers were also knocked out. They lost 2-0 at home to Slavia Prague, 3-1 on aggregate. Rangers had two men sent off in that game. The draw for the quarterfinals of both the Europa League and the Champions League takes place today at 11 o'clock, and you can watch it live on RTE News Now. Tonight sees the start of the Electricity League, with champions Shamrock Rovers hosting St Pat's and Waterford going to Drogheda. The Rovers-Pats game is live on RTE. Waterford and Drogheda can be seen on Watch LOI. It's a tough task for St Pat's going to Talla, but their manager, Stephen O'Donnell, is relishing the prospect.
Just really looking forward to it. You can't get a much better game or a much bigger game live on RTE. And you're playing the league champions' first game of the season in a great venue in Talla Stadium, and a lovely surface, a lovely pitch. So we're also well aware it's going to be a very difficult match. You know, they are league champions. They were the best team in the league last year. So we're going to have to be at the top of our game to get something, but it's one we're looking forward to.
In rugby news, Scotland's postponed Six Nations match against France in Paris has been rearranged for next Friday night, March 26th. And meanwhile, as Ireland prepare to take on England in the Six Nations tomorrow, recalled Irish scrum half Conor Murray has been talking to Michael Corcoran about the challenge that Ireland face.
Huge. Anytime you play England, home or away, particularly at home, it's a massive occasion. It's one that doesn't take any motivation from the leaders. It's just there, you can feel it during the week. So that has been the case this week, and lads are chomping at the bit to go. You don't need to say much. You know, the atmosphere is already there.
I can ask you just one final question. Do you think that it's unfair that some people have kind of tagged you as a box kicking scrum half? There are other elements to your game.
Yeah, that's just what the kind of outside noise is, I suppose, from time to time. But, you know, I've huge belief in what we're doing here, and the coaches are the very same. You know, they back you to you know, back yourself and put on a show and you know, back your skill set. And it, for me, it definitely goes further than kicking the ball in the air. That's obviously a big part of the tactics in international rugby. It's something that we do well. England do it really well. So, you know, that'll be one element of what's to come at the weekend.
And that game is live on Saturday Sport tomorrow. We'll have Donal Lennon's verdict on the game in the next hour. Meanwhile, there are three games this evening in the Guinness Pro 14. Leinster versus Ospreys, Munster versus Benetton, and Ulster play Zebre. Finally for now, some golf news. Shane Lowry is in a tie for ninth place going into the second round of the Honda Classic in Florida. Shane's on 3 under par, 6 shots behind the leader, Australia's Matt Jones. Padraig Harrington is 2 over par, and Graham McDowell finished on 9 over.
Former President Mary McAleese is among those criticising Pope Francis after the Vatican upheld a ban on the blessing of same-sex marriages or unions earlier this week, ruling they were not valid. The Association of Catholic Priests has called the decision divisive and showing breathtaking certainty about what God can and cannot do. Father Tim Hazelwood from the Association is on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Anya.
When you say the Vatican is showing breathtaking certainty in their assumptions about what God can and cannot do, what do you mean in this context?
Well, just to explain firstly that I am not a moral theologian. I'm a priest working in a parish here in East Cork. So I suppose we work from, most of us who are involved in the association work from our experience of working and meeting and just interacting with people within the parish. And that includes people and families who have somebody who's in a same-sex relationship. And our experience is that You know, they're lovely couples. And to hear something like that, you know, that their relationship is sinful, like, that's, like, I wonder how many of them know and meet and interact with those families and those people. But I think there's a deeper issue, I think, involved here, if you don't mind me explaining a little bit about what's going on. Pope Francis has introduced this synodality way forward for the church, which means that issues are now going to be brought to the surface, and that is, it's coming at the moment from a synod that's being held in Germany, where the German bishops have said, some of them openly, mm-hmm. that they are going to be blessing same-sex unions. So obviously some complained to Rome, and that was sent to the Congregation of Doctrine and Faith, and they have come out with this. So Pope Francis is in a very difficult position, because you have a whole group within the church who would back what the congregation are saying, and then there are others who have a different view, and Pope Francis is trying to balance both. And it's very difficult. He has said some very positive things about inclusiveness and including gay people in, you know, and people, all peoples on the margins involved in what's going on in the church. But to listen to that statement, it was so disappointing, and it was appalling, really.
Mary McAleese says Pope Francis has raised hopes, but he toes the old hard line. Do you agree?
The words come out that way, but I'm not in the position where I have to hold all the parts together. He's trying, like, in parts of the world, including especially in the United States, and we even here in Ireland, like, we would have a very hardcore group who would be very anti-Pope Francis and anti the changes and the new breath of life that he's bringing. And I can understand where Mary McAleese is coming from, and for a lot of people and families, it's very disappointing. But like, does he want to cause a schism in the church, a split? I don't think he does. But
it is doctrine. I mean, it's a reminder of doctrine, isn't it? And this is like, what do you do? Would you bless a gay couple who came to you and said, we would like our marriage, our union blessed?
The only thing I'll say to you is, just 2 days ago, there was pieces of weed that grows on the ground, and I blessed them. I blessed shamrock. Now, if two people stand in front of me and they love each other and they're committing to each other for the rest of their lives, and I bless shamrock and I wouldn't bless them, no, I don't think there's a doubt or a question there.
So you would?
But like, churches teaching on what marriage means and all that, that hasn't changed. But like, in Ireland we're going to have a synod in the next 5 years. It's the bishops have announced it. And the bishops have said that they want people, especially on the margins, to be part of. Would any gay person come near a church that says things like this?
Look, this is a huge topic, and I'm sorry we've very little time, so this has to be my final question to you. But given that this is the doctrine which has been reaffirmed by the Vatican, where does that leave you and people like you in the Catholic Church now? As you've said, you would bless, you know, you'll bless plants, you'll bless people if you're asked.
But there's an awful difference between somebody in Rome making a promulgation and what's the lived experience of the church. And I think a lot of priests would say, like, if Christ was here with us now, what would Christ do? He would do the caring, the loving thing. He was the one who he challenged all of these rules himself. And Pope Francis is asking us to talk about these things. You know, this is the way forward, where people with different, and it's going to be an awful lot more of this in the church, which is a good thing.
All right.
It's opening things up.
Well, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on Morning Ireland today. That's Father Tim Hazelwood for the Association of Catholic Priests in Ireland.
The Bar Council of Ireland has adapted its transition year programme for students interested in pursuing a career in law. Now, normally there's a limit of 100 pupils taking part every year, but the COVID pandemic has taken the course online, making it accessible to all TY students around the country. There are now over 10,000 pupils signed up to take part in the five-week course. Our regional reporter Teresa Mannion reports.
Hello, my name is Frank Clark. I'm the Chief Justice of Ireland, and it's a great pleasure for me to welcome you to this transition year programme. Understanding what role the courts play, what role judges play, what role lawyers play in our legal system is a very important part of understanding the country in which we live.
We're starting this morning on module 4. It's media and the law.
Cailleadh de Aithne in Salt Hill in Galway is one of 320 schools across the country participating in this year's TY Law course. Here's teacher Anne Collins.
Here at Cailleadh de Aithne, we're a DISH school. It has levelled the playing field. There's equal opportunity. It's all of our 66 TY students could sign up for this online programme. And if in normal times, in normal circumstances, we'd be lucky to get one in. So it's a real positive.
Robert O'Reilly is 16 and a TY student at Cailleadh de Aithne.
I'm actually enjoying it quite a lot. I think it's very user-friendly, the actual course. And you learn a lot from the different barristers, like the young barristers and maybe the more experienced ones. They can teach you a lot during the presentations. There was a young barrister named Amy who didn't actually get enough points in the Leaving Cert to study law, so she had to work her way around that.
Hi everyone, my name is Amy Hughes. I have been a barrister now for nearly 4 months, so not very long. I am devilling at the moment, so that's the first year that you come to the bar and you work under a master. I'm the first in my family to go to third level education. I went to school in St Dominic's in Cabra, and then I went and did an arts degree in UCD. Plenty of years of studying, and I kind of went the scenic route because I didn't get enough points in the Leaving Cert to do law originally. So in terms of my route, I would say the Leaving Cert is important, but it's not the end of the world. There's so many other routes.
The TY course covers a broad range of material, from explaining civil and criminal law, breaking down legal terminology, to showing the importance of good communication skills in the courtroom. Here's CEO Mary Griffin.
I'm delighted to have this opportunity to talk to transition year students about the King's Inns. It is where you learn how to become a barrister, learning to speak up for people in a court and put forward the best argument you can. You learn to become an excellent communicator. You learn to think quickly on your feet. If you don't want to work in court, standing and presenting in front of judges, barristers have lots of other careers. They work in Facebook, in Twitter, in the Central Bank, in SurveyMonkey.
John Ward worked in Mountjoy Jail for 30 years before becoming a barrister.
I was called to the bar in October 2011, just over 9 years ago, and in a manner of speaking, I was called to the bar from behind bars. I think this is one of the reasons why I do what I am doing now, was I was attending trials in court, sometimes handcuffed to an inmate, other times just escorting. There is an old saying, do not judge others until you have walked in their shoes. It's a good basis to start from, and it brings me nicely to one question I am frequently asked. How does it feel representing people who are guilty? It is not for me to decide if they are guilty. It is for a jury. If their guilt is obvious, they will be convicted. Most people plead guilty anyway.
Amy O'Reilly is a sister of TY pupil Robert and a final year law student at NUI Galway.
I actually did my work experience down in UCC in the law department, and it was amazing to get the opportunity to actually go and see what the life was of a barrister from day to day, or a solicitor. But I feel like with what Robert's doing, it's brilliant because it opens a lot of doors for people to actually learn about what it is to do law. I think it was 10,000 students registered. That's amazing to, you know, someone could have not considered a career in law and then through this course could have found that they actually would really be interested in it.
People think it is difficult to get in or become a barrister unless you're connected to the legal profession. That is simply not true. And we welcome students from all across the country and from all walks of life, any age and any background.
And that's Mary Griffin, the CEO and under-treasurer at the King's Inns, ending that report by Theresa Mannion. And for those of you who haven't registered, students will be able to access the course modules up until the end of April.
Imports from Britain slumped by 65% in January, according to the CSO, in what is the first concrete sign of Brexit's impact on trade. At the same time, exports to Britain fell by 14%. There are some complicating factors to the figures. Many firms may have stockpiled goods ahead of the Brexit deadline, while there are more challenges facing trading firms ahead. Carol Lynch, partner in BDO's Customs and International Trade Services Department, joins me to talk through some of that. Firstly, Carol, on those January figures, do we know how much was due to Brexit and how much was simply due to stockpiling?
Hi, Adam. No, we can't tell the difference in terms of breaking down what is stockpiling and what is related to customs requirements, for example, or fear of customs requirements, or Brexit or COVID. So it's not possible to break it down between each of the different elements. All we really know is that there has been a two-thirds reduction in imports over January from January last year, which is obviously very substantial. And you would have expected some reduction, but that does seem very, very high.
There are still a lot of question marks around the rules for trading across the Irish Sea, even now 2.5 months on. What have traders who are still importing, exporting, what have they been doing in the past 2.5 months to try and manage that?
Really working on the operational side of things and trying to get familiar with the actual customs procedures. So while people may have, and a lot of people did prepare, particularly in Ireland last year, for customs requirements, it's quite different when you're actually having to comply with the law on a day-by-day basis and tie that in with your haulage requirements. So there's been a lot of work in pulling together documentation, in giving advance notification to customs. That's probably one of the biggest issues that you have to, say, for example, for food products, give 24 hours notice of import, which does impact the supply chain quite significantly. You have to have funds in your customs accounts. That's certainly been a delaying issue where people haven't had enough funds to pay the customs duty. You need to make sure that you have things like tariff classifications correct. That has certainly caused a lot of holdups where they have been incorrect. So really getting to grips with the day-to-day operational requirements of lodging customs declarations, giving advance notice to the Revenue or the Department of Agriculture, and having all the details correct has taken some time.
Now, there are maybe two challenges on the horizon here. First, firms that did stockpile, they're probably starting to run out of the reserves and maybe having to now look at importing again and facing all of those challenges. We also have new rules coming into force from April. So do we potentially have a lot more problems at customs crossings in the next few weeks?
Yes. What we would have seen is that a lot of companies didn't import in January and February while they waited for things to settle down, and they had stockpiles that they could work off so they weren't under pressure. Those reserves are now running out, and we're certainly seeing companies starting to prepare to import in March and in April. And as a result, there's a lot of people coming now into the customs net again who haven't imported over January and February and who will be facing these issues for the first time. So they really need to learn from the January-February experience and ensure that they have the processes in place, get the procedures in place, ensure they understand the classifications, the TANs, the VAT, etc., and really plan that out. And in terms of April, we have new rules coming in for composite products, which are being imported into Ireland, well, into the EU. So there's new health cert requirements for composite products, which are quite complicated. And again, people who are importing in the food industry need to really completely understand those requirements, because certainly over January and February, a lot of the products that were being held at customs were held due to incorrect health certs.
So a lot more challenges ahead for companies involved in importing and exporting. Carol Lynch, partner at BDO's Customs and International Trade Services Department, thank you very much for that. More business news in the next hour. For now, though, it's back to you, Anya.
At 8:03, let's go over to Gavin Gallagher at Met Éireann for the weekend weather forecast.
Thank you very much. Good morning and welcome to Met Éireann. So it's cloudy across the country today, but it's dry as well in most areas. And with high pressure nearby until early next week, we will have similar weather conditions over the weekend. Mostly cloudy, a little bit of drizzle drifting in from now and then across the weekend. The drizzle then becomes a little bit more widespread on Monday, and then with the high pressure moving away, this allows more unsettled weather to arrive in from the west on Tuesday of next week with some rain and breezier conditions for midweek. Back to the present then, so it's dry today and it's cloudy as well, but there will be sunny spells as well, especially in Munster, South Leinster and along the east coast. There may also be a few spots of drizzle near northwestern coasts and hills today, but not amounting to very much. We're looking at highs of around 9 to 13 degrees, mildest in Munster, in light to moderate northerly breeze. Continuing mostly cloudy overnight tonight then, it will be a little patchy drizzle drifting across the country as well at times, but most areas will be dry. Patches of mist will form as well, as the winds tonight will be very light, and it won't be a cold night with temperatures not falling below 5 degrees or so. So for the weekend, both days will be grey and overcast, but mostly dry, but the cloud will be thick enough at times to give us a little bit of drizzle, mainly on western and northern hills and coasts. And the temperatures overall for the weekend and into next week will be around average for this time of year. And that's your forecast. Have a very good morning.
Good morning. You're listening to Morning Ireland with Mary Wilson and Áine Lawler. At a minute past eight, let's get the news headlines. The news bulletin, I beg your pardon, from Vivian Traynor.
The National Public Health Emergency Team is expected to issue an update on the use of AstraZeneca vaccine today, following meetings with the National Immunisation Advisory Committee and the Health Products Regulatory Authority later this morning. An investigation by the European Medicines Agency concluded yesterday that the vaccine is not associated with an increase in the overall risk of blood clots, but may be associated with very rare clots. The EMA said the benefits of the vaccine continue to outweigh the risk of side effects, but that product information for the vaccine should be updated to include more information on these risks. Our environment and science correspondent George Lee.
The HSE has about 50,000 doses of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine in its cold storage facility, ready to go. In addition, it is expecting a delivery of another 9,600 doses from the company before the end of this weekend. There are also stocks of the vaccine in fridges at certain locations, including Beaumont Hospital, where one infectious disease consultant said yesterday that vaccinations with AstraZeneca could be turned on within hours for in-house patients and other vulnerable people. All that is required is the green light from the Minister for Health to the HSE to restart the rollout after the completion of the EMA safety review yesterday. Before that can happen, however, NEFID, the National Immunisation Committee and the Health Products Regulatory Authority have to agree a position, issue an update and advise the Minister. It is expected that that will happen today. The HSE said it will respond quickly to whatever decision is made, but that it could take a few days to get the specific vaccination programmes that were paused last weekend back up and running.
While countries including Italy, France, Germany and Spain are resuming use of the AstraZeneca vaccine, Norway, along with Sweden and Denmark, is reviewing the EMA verdict that the vaccine's benefits outweigh the risks. The Norwegian Medicines Agency said it will take a longer pause before deciding whether or not to resume. Its medical director, Dr. Steinar Madsen, told RTE's Primetime last night that the country's main concern was that the adverse reactions occurred in those under the age of 55, and experts said they had not seen anything like it before.
The problem is that the people who were affected by these reactions were young people, and they have a very small chance of getting severe COVID disease, so that's one problem. We have vaccinated only 120,000 people with this vaccine and six cases. That's one in 20,000 with a very severe and life-threatening reaction. So it's been a problem, that's for sure.
The British government intends to take on new powers that would allow it to compel the Stormont executive to provide abortion services in Northern Ireland. The DUP and the Ulster Unionist Party are likely to challenge the move. From Belfast, our Northern editor Tommy Gorman.
There's an inevitability about this row. When Stormont was closed, the British government introduced legislation in Westminster that would allow for the provision of abortion services in Northern Ireland. Even though power sharing was restored a year ago, the Stormont Health Minister, Robin Swan, has not put services commissioning structures in place. His view is the issue is a matter for the full executive, not just his department. It would seem the British government is no longer prepared to tolerate the stalemate. Regulations are expected to be brought to Westminster next week that would allow the Northern Ireland Secretary to intervene. the DUP and perhaps the Ulster Unionist Party may seek a judicial review. They may query the right of the British government to bypass the devolved government structure. Sinn Féin is pushing the health minister to establish the services in the different health trusts. Tommy Gorman, RTE News, Belfast.
China and the United States have clashed over policy at the first high-level meeting of officials since President Biden took office. At the opening of the talks in Alaska, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said China's policies towards Hong Kong, Taiwan and the Uyghur Muslims, along with its cyber activity and economic coercion, threaten the system of rules that maintain global stability. Mr. Blinken said the US would not shy away from contentious issues. China's top diplomat, Yang Jiechia, said Beijing followed United Nations rules. He called on the US to stop advancing its own version of democracy, especially when dealing with internal social turmoil and race issues. And now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 Weather with Centra. We're working hard to provide a safe environment so you can shop safely in your local Centra.
Mostly dry and rather cloudy today. There will be some sunny spells, especially in Munster, South Leinster and along the east coast. There may be a few spots of drizzle near northwestern coasts and hills. Highest temperatures 9 to 13 degrees.
The Irish Independent reports in its lead story that tough COVID-19 restrictions are likely to remain until sometime in June. The Deputy Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Ronan Glynn, is quoted as saying that people should expect to be working from home full-time for the next 3 or 4 months. The plan is to proceed very cautiously on the basis of the data in front of us for as long as it takes, he said. Bed down until June, says the Irish Daily Mail headline over a report that Dr. Glynn signalled little change on the 5th of April. And ministers are split on easing the 5 kilometre travel restriction next month, according to the Irish Times. The Irish Examiner highlights the statement by the Health Service Executive that it will be a period of days before the AstraZeneca vaccine will be given to the public here. Other European countries will start administering AstraZeneca from today, the paper says, after the European Medicines Agency confirmed that it is not associated with an increase in the overall risk of blood clots in those who receive it. The Northern Ireland Health Minister, Robin Swan, meanwhile, has moved to reassure the public following news of a delay in delivery of AstraZeneca. The Irish News reports him saying that all adults in the north are still expected to be offered their first COVID vaccine by the end of July. The race meeting at Cheltenham provides the main story for two papers. The Irish Sun reports on Paul Dean, a canny punter, as it calls him, who cashed out his €5 5-leg accumulator for €300,000 after the first 4 nags romped home. He breathed a sigh of relief when his 5th horse fell, the paper says. Wonder Woman is the Irish Daily Mirror's headline. That's the jockey Rachel Blackmore, who the paper says is tipped to become the first female rider to win the Gold Cup and the first woman to scoop the Cheltenham Top Jockey Award. In other front page stories, The Times reports that Mary McAleese, former president, has criticised Pope Francis as a populist who raises expectations only to dash them. This follows the publication of a Vatican document approved by the Pope, which sustained a ban on same-sex blessings. The Independent picks up on the finding by the Central Statistics Office that 2,267 households in the state have no piped water supply, and almost the same number said they had no sewerage facility of any kind. The Examiner looks at a study by researchers at Queen's University Belfast, which found that cows who suffered what it calls livestock lockdown may have been damaged emotionally. And there is much attention given to the suggestion by a Minister of State, Josepha Madigan, that the name of the newspaper, The Kerryman, be given a more gender-neutral title, such as The Kerry Person. Laura Colgan, in a column in The Star, says of Ms. Madigan, "I'd like to see her champion real-life causes like pay parity, childcare and gender-based violence over a non-issue that won't make a blind bit of difference to any of us." A letter writer in The Times has a suggestion with biblical overtones about the minister's own name. Jason Power of Dartry, Dublin, says if she has a sexist issue with the name of the Kerry man, then at the very least Josepha Madigan should lead by example and change her first name to Maria.
And as we know, the National Immunisation Advisory Committee will meet this morning to finalise its response to yesterday's European Medicines Agency finding that there's no overall increase in the risk of blood clots with the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine. The EMA's Safety Committee said the vaccination's proven efficacy in preventing hospitalisation and death from COVID outweighed the extremely small likelihood of developing these rare clots. Here's Executive Director Eimear Cook.
The committee has come to a clear scientific conclusion. This is a safe and effective vaccine. Its benefits in protecting people from COVID-19 with the associated risks of death and hospitalisation outweigh the possible risks. The committee also concluded that the vaccine is not associated with an increase in the overall risk of thromboembolic events or blood clots.
Now, here to explain some more about this vaccination, Professor Joe Harbison, consultant stroke physician and clinical lead on the Irish National Audit of Stroke. Professor Harbison, you're welcome to Morning Ireland.
Thank you very much, Mary.
Now, safe and effective, Eimear Cook said there, but in light of the controversy we've had and the attention that's focused on the AstraZeneca vaccine and any links to blood clots, what would your advice be to people now who, despite the assurances they've received, may still be nervous about receiving AstraZeneca?
Oh, I mean, the vaccine is safe. It's pretty clearly safe. And now, if you think about it, the EMA report said that the vaccine's been given, over 20 million doses of vaccine have been given, and they found 18 cases of this. So it's one in a million chance, or less than a one in a million chance of developing a problem. Now, the reason why they're concerned is this particular type of clot is a reasonably uncommon clot, and that is occurring in the brain, and it can occasionally result in stroke. It doesn't always result in stroke. I think the most famous person to get one of these was Hillary Clinton back in 2012, and she recovered very well from it. But it can be associated with stroke in younger people. But I have to emphasize, the risk of stroke from catching COVID is substantially higher than the risk of developing any problem with the vaccine.
And people might be unaware of that connection between COVID. Let's park the vaccine for a moment and talk about this, that this connection between COVID and the presentation of stroke. What are you seeing?
Well, about 1% to 2% of people who are hospitalised with COVID, we're now discovering are suffering stroke. And they also, we're also seeing more what we call large vessel strokes, or very major strokes, occurring in young people with COVID. It's one of these hidden complications of stroke or of COVID that really hasn't been much publicised. So if you wonder, well, we were doing the recent NOCA report looking at the experience of stroke services during the pandemic. It hasn't been quite published yet, but we found that there were about 30 cases of stroke in Ireland during the first wave associated with COVID. So if you think that's in Ireland in the first wave, there were more cases of stroke associated with COVID than there have been in the entire reported planet associated with the vaccine.
So a risk of stroke from COVID much greater than any risk there might be from taking a vaccine like AstraZeneca.
That's certainly what it appears.
Are there other medications that we take, many of us in the course of our lives, or vaccines indeed that we take, that carry with them maybe a risk of clots?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few ones. The commonest one that people would be most familiar with would be things like the oral contraceptive pill is associated with clots. And to a certain extent, things like HRT. And all these circumstances, in all drugs, you always weigh the benefit versus the risk. And you're also aware of the risk. I would argue that the risk of developing cerebral sinus thrombosis is probably higher, with something like the OCP than it would be with the vaccine. But remember, you can also increase your risk of developing OCP or developing cerebral sinus thrombosis from, for instance, being a smoker. That will increase your clots, your risk of clotting as well, far more than taking AstraZeneca vaccine would.
The thing is, though, if somebody receives the AstraZeneca vaccine, and we are hearing reports of people suffering, maybe in some cases even severe side effects from the AstraZeneca vaccine, how do I know what is an acceptable severe side effect and what might be a danger zone where I require attention?
Well, what the EMA report yesterday came out with, it described particular features. So what they said in terms of these cerebral sinus thrombosis is if somebody gets a very severe and particularly a progressive headache over a number of days, that is a warning signal you should contact your doctor. And if you pick up these symptoms, a mild headache isn't uncommon with a vaccine. And to a certain extent, people who get a mild response to the vaccine should be encouraged, because it suggests they're getting an immune response that suggests their immune system is picking up the vaccine and responding to it. But what they pick up is a particularly a headache that's getting worse for 2 or 3 days, particularly worse in the mornings. It would be something that they would flag and you should go see your doctor about. But the big thing about this is that they've identified the problem. They've identified the issue. It's not even a problem. They've identified the issue. They've identified the scale of it. They've now characterized it. And I think in those circumstances, people are very encouraged that they can go back and start administering the vaccine again.
Is there a cohort, though, where you would advise against this vaccine? People, for example, who might have a family history of stroke, or people as well who ask, is there any way I can prepare?
Well, I think the NIAC will give advice on that about who they think. It's probably sensible that, for instance, somebody who's previously had a cerebral sinus thrombosis, they do happen. I mean, I will have seen 2 or 3 of them this year spontaneously. I think they'd probably give advice that if you've had one of those before, they may think about a different vaccine. But overall, remember that the risk of clots is not increased by this vaccine. It's only this one subset. So I think in general, they'd encourage to take that on. You'd also have to say that what would you do to prepare? So, for instance, some people suggest maybe give aspirin. Yes. But actually, the current evidence would be that actually perhaps taking an aspirin, given the very low risk of this, taking aspirin may be associated with more risk than the vaccine, even though the risk with aspirin is tiny. Mm.
And yet we have countries like Norway in particular here, where they had these small number of cases, who are still taking a longer pause. They're not acting immediately on the EMA advice yesterday. Would you support that abundance of caution approach that's being taken by Norway, and it appears maybe Sweden and Denmark as well?
I'm not sure what, I mean, they've obviously are in a different situation. We're not quite clear why Norway has particularly identified this as where it particularly become an issue within Norway. I mean, for instance, the UK has used many, many times the amount of this vaccine than Norway have, and probably in a broader range of people, and haven't seen the issue. So we're not quite sure what's going on with that. The other issue, of course, with Norway is they're in a different circumstance in terms of the caseload, although it has to be said that their rate of virus has gone up substantially in the last couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, and it's actually now higher than Ireland. Up to date, they've had about 650 deaths out of a population of about 6 million people. So they've been very careful about this. Mm-hmm. And we're always cautious when we're giving a vaccine. Remember, when we give a vaccine, we're giving a drug to a healthy person. So there is an abundance of caution there. But I think across the board, and looking at the worldwide experience, the global experience, particularly with our nearest neighbour, I would feel very encouraged about using this again. If they were to offer it to my family, I'd suggest, yes, certainly, absolutely take it. You know, it's much better to get the vaccine and be safe than risk COVID, which can give you, much more unpleasant side effects.
Professor Joe Harbison, thank you very much indeed. It's 22 minutes past 8.
Now, Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon faces the fight of her political life as the Scottish National Party, the SNP, is torn apart in a bitter row between Ms Sturgeon and former leader Alex Salmond. Mr Salmond was acquitted of 13 charges of sexual assault in March last year. He also won a legal challenge against a government inquiry into sexual harassment claims against him. A Scottish Parliament committee has been holding hearings into how all this came about, both Mr. Salmond and Ms. Sturgeon gave lengthy and differing versions of what happened to that committee, and last night it was reported the committee had voted by a narrow majority that Nicola Sturgeon had given them an inaccurate account. However, the First Minister insisted last night she'd told the truth. She claimed this was a partisan leak. So for more on what's going on, I'm joined by Paul Hutchin, political editor with the Daily Record newspaper in Scotland. A partisan leak, Nicola Sturgeon claims. How critical this reported vote from the committee, Paul?
Well, I think it's a serious issue for the First Minister. This committee was set up to get to the bottom of how the government messed up a sexual misconduct probe into Alex Salmond, a mess up that cost the taxpayer over £600,000. And so for the committee to look at all the facts and decide that on a key issue, the First Minister misled the parliamentary committee is not good for her, particularly on the eve of a Holyrood election. Of course, this is a committee full of politicians. She would probably say that it's her political enemies who are behind this recommendation. So I would expect a deep and long political row to develop now.
It's basically a he said, she said, isn't it, about what she knew, whether she'd promised to try and help her former leader, whether he'd misunderstood.
That's right. One of the central issues is that Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond had a meeting at her house in April 2018 in the middle of the investigation into Mr. Salmond. And one of the issues at that meeting is whether or not Nicola Sturgeon offered to intervene and assist Mr. Salmond. He says that she did make the offer. He was backed up by his lawyer, who was also at the house that day. Nicola Sturgeon has denied an offer of assistance. And in terms of a committee recommendation, it's on that central point. They say that her written evidence was inaccurate and that she misled the committee on this matter. And they also say that this is a potential breach of the ministerial code. So it's it wasn't a particularly good night for the First Minister, but I expect her to come out swinging today.
And is her job on the line?
I think it is on the line. There is a second investigation underway by a QC called James Hamilton. Now, he's not a politician. He's looking specifically at whether Nicola Sturgeon breached the ministerial code or not. And I do think that that is the more critical report for her. It's not a committee full of politicians. He's not got a political bias at all. And I think if he was to come back with a negative finding, she would find that very difficult to survive. But as things stand just now, in terms of this committee recommendation, although she's in tricky political waters, I think that she'll probably survive.
Paul Hutchin, political editor with the Daily Record newspaper in Scotland, thank you. It's 26 minutes past eight.
Rachel Blackmore continued to dominate the Cheltenham Festival yesterday. Two more wins brought her winning haul to seven this week so far. And those wins include making history in the champion hurdle on Honeysuckle, the first female jockey to win this race. Today she's competing in the Gold Cup. Well, Cian McCormack visited her home, Killinall, in County Tipperary, where proud locals and family are celebrating her success.
Oh, big fan of Rachel from day one. Just so delighted for her.
Mary O'Connor is standing outside her home on Killinall's main street.
It's brilliant for the town of Killinall. It's brilliant for her family.
As you can hear, she's excited.
During COVID, it has lifted everyone's spirits.
So much so, she's decorated her front window.
Just a picture of Rachel coming in and another picture of her down here and the Irish flags. Just, we follow Rachel the whole time.
People here are proud of what Rachel Blackmore has achieved. Local man James O'Gorman.
You're in the horse racing country today here in Killinall. Down the road you have Edward O'Grady's stable, you have Slattery's stable, and then you go into Fittert you have Mouse Morris, and you have the Coolmore Empire Den as well. With Rachel, of course, it's fantastic what she has achieved. She can hold her own with any of the jockeys, men or women, it doesn't matter. She's so strong.
A steady stream of locals make their way to and from John O'Dwyer's Butchers. First, there's former Tipperary hurler Donie O'Connell.
I've been going to Cheltenham for over 25 years. This is the first year I've missed it. And to miss it this year was just heartbreaking. And especially when the local girl comes up and wins the big prize, you know, it's a shame.
Redmond Carl. who's involved with horses locally, has a few words to say too.
Rachel is something else. She's got brains, she's got guts, and that's what you need.
It's at O'Dwyer's Butchers that I'm due to meet Rachel Blackmore's mum, Emer.
One strip line, yeah.
Its owner, John O'Dwyer, explains what makes Rachel a top jockey.
Rachel is very special from the point of view that she's her own girl. You need to be tough when you're up there, and more so when you're riding these good horses and you're expected to win. Thumbs up to her.
They head towards the first, you know what I mean, Harry.
As we wait, the 1:55 race from Cheltenham starts on a small, tiny TV in a back room at the Butchers.
Quickly towards the second, Redford Road and Potter's Hedge are.
As the race nears its end, Emer Blackmore arrives.
The market mover of this morning.
It's not the norm for Emer to be watching one of her daughter's races.
Normally at home, I might have the race on. I will be pottering about doing chores around the house, and I'll probably watch it from the three fences to go. But I can't watch the whole thing.
Over a half an hour later, Emer visits the local creamery.
This is Arthur.
Harry Arthur.
She introduces me to Arthur Kennedy, who she says predicted Rachel would find fantastic form this week.
Arthur said to me that, you know, she's going to do it. So I was saying, oh, don't put the jinx in her, Arthur.
Everyone said that there was something special there. She was never nervous, even when she was starting off, being up beside Davy Russell, Ruby Welsh. She was never intimidated by him. She rode her own race, and they rode their race.
We move to a quiet shed at the back of the creamery, so Emer can do an interview in private.
Any parent would get nervous watching their child doing what she has chosen to do. I just want her home safe.
Oh, yeah.
Then yes, the child? Interview is interrupted. Emer's phone rings on silent.
Okay, that's amazing, pet.
It's her husband, Charles.
She won. She won.
What's that?
She won on Aloha. Thank you. Bye.
We're just talking. Your husband, Charles, has just rang.
Yeah.
It's now 2:37. What happened?
Rachel's just after winning on Aloha. According to Charles, she did really well.
Rachel has won the 2:30 Ryanair chase at Cheltenham.
How are you feeling?
Oh, I'm delighted for her. I'm absolutely delighted. It's just wonderful. This win today now will mean a lot to her.
You have a whole heap of text messages now after that last race. But, you know, what are people saying to you?
People are saying she's the Queen of Cheltenham. In tears watching. The phone is melting, actually. I'm so delighted. I'm delighted people are getting a bit of joy out of it. Horse racing needs it.
There's excitement returning to O'Dwyer's.
Yeah, I did, I saw that, yeah. Fantastic. Fantastic, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's applause all round for Killinall's hero, Rachel. And here, they're saying at the end of this week, they'll be singing in the hills of Killinall.
Yes, it's lovely around the hills of Killinall.
And I'm nearly in tears listening to Cian McCormack's lovely report there from Killinall.
Ulster Bank owner NatWest is to buy back £1.1 billion worth of shares from the UK government. The deal for almost 591 million shares brings the UK government's shareholding in the banking group from 61.7% to just under 59.8%. The owner of Aer Lingus has increased the amount of money it plans to raise through bond sales following higher than expected interest from markets. IAG now plans to raise €1.2 billion through two bond sales, opposed to the €1 billion it announced yesterday morning. The bonds will mature in 2025 and 2029 and will have interest rates of 2.75% and 3.75% respectively. And the Nikkei in Tokyo fell by 1.4% overnight after the Bank of Japan tweaked its monetary easing policy. The central bank maintained its negative interest rates but removed a requirement to buy a minimum amount of bonds each month. It also said it would now focus any purchases of funds on those listed on the TOPIX index only. Finally, the currencies, €1 buying you $1 and 19.3 cents and 85.6 pence sterling.
And Des has all the Friday sports news.
Yeah, and lots of it on you. It's Gold Cup Day, album photo seeking a remarkable three in a row. And yet, that incredible story is kind of overshadowed by the prospect of Rachel Blackmore finishing as leading jockey at the festival. She had two more winners yesterday on Aloha and Tell Me Something Girl. It means she leads now the jockey's table with five winners. Well, one of the women who knows all about the pressures of the big races is Nina Carberry, who, along with Katie Walsh, blazed the trail for Irish horsewomen. Good morning to you, Nina. I sense you haven't been too surprised by Rachel's success.
No, just the dedication that she has to the sport is incredible. And now she's getting the chances, and we're really seeing what she can do. And obviously, when you get put up on those horses, you hope that you're going to do your best, and she's definitely done that and above this week. And along with that, she's got three or four falls as well, so she's able to pick herself up off the ground and not like put that behind her and go again, you know. So it's actually incredible to watch, and I'm so delighted for her. And no, it's brilliant. It's a great week for her.
And tell us, what are the challenges women face in what has traditionally been a man's world? I mean, strength, is that a factor in making the weight? What are the biggest challenges?
To be honest, to me, I've always thought if you're tactically good enough, you can ride races, and if you're able to take the falls, which Rachel is, and touch wood, she keeps injury free and that. But to me, if you're on the best horse, you have to be tactically good. It doesn't matter how strong you are in a finish. I feel that it doesn't really make a difference. But she's tactically.
Okay, the line's just dropped out. We'll come back to Nina in a moment. But Rupert Bell joins us live from Cheltenham. We'll talk about the weather in a moment, Rupert. But what's the reaction to Rachel over in the UK?
Well, I mean, we've sort of known that she's good, but now she's just confirmed it to the British racing public. And what Nina said there is the overriding impression is that, yes, she's on the best horses, but tactically she is just so astute. And you can see it, that she can make the right decision. And when you've got two greats of the game, AP McCoy and Ruby Walsh, saying that there's no one else riding better than her, then you have to agree with them, because they know more about it than anybody. And I think that's what's been fantastic. Yes, she's had those bone-crunching falls, and she's as tough as they come. But what is also highlighting just her supreme confidence, and that ride on Aloho. I mean, I was watching it with Lizzie Kelly, who's won Cheltenham Festival races, and she at the end of it had her eyes bulging on stalks, because she just couldn't believe what she'd seen from the ride that Rachel gave that horse.
Right. And Nina Carberry, do you think Rachel will finish as leading jockey?
She has every chance. Obviously, Paul Townend and Jack Kennedy are bang there, but they have to make up. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
They have to make up the two wins today. So all Rachel has to do is try and have one more win, but they're going to find it very hard to catch her today.
Well, it would be some achievement, and without heaping pressure on her, of course. Rupert, the weather today has changed, I believe, at Cheltenham.
Yeah, the official ground is good to soft, good in places for a Gold Cup day. But I tell you what, it's dreek and damp here this morning. So we have had drizzle for the last sort of hour or so. So, and it might mean that it could just juice it up a bit, and those who are hoping for a really quick ground may not get it if it continues. But the weather forecast suggests it might dry up. But as I say, we've had a damp morning here. But hopefully we'll have a brilliant Gold Cup to round off this most extraordinary of festivals, which currently stands with absolute total humiliation for British trainers. And thankfully, Nicky Henderson is flying the flag from a domestic point of view. But let's just say we will remember this at the moment as Blackmore's Festival.
All right. And can I get your tip for the Gold Cup, Nina?
Should we have to go for... I suppose Album Photo, we'd love to see him do the three in the row, but it'd be absolutely brilliant if Rachel could do the double and champion hurdle and a Gold Cup. So it's great. There's great stories ahead, so hopefully everyone comes back safe and sound and we have a good day today.
Great stuff, Nina. Thanks. And Rupert, what's your fancy in the Gold Cup?
Champ. In the JP McManus colours, trained by Nicky Henderson, but maybe I'm just being a bit blinkered with going for a British trained runner. It's probably very stupid of me given the way your lot are running over here.
And what makes you go for Champ?
Well, he was brilliant in what was the RSA last year. He's had a strange preparation. He ran over 2 miles, but Nicky Henderson is a master at getting them right, and that looked a very encouraging run. And we also know he runs well here. He's quirky, and it's not going to be a straightforward ride, but I tell you what, this Gold Cup looks a really fascinating one. Aplutard, I think, will probably go over our favourite because of the Blackmore effect, as it were. But I think I'd love to see Native River run well. But I just think Champ might just have the key. It was an extraordinary moment when he won last year in the RSA, coming out of nowhere. But if he can get a good ride, I think we'll be there or thereabouts.
Okay, Rupert Bell and the great Nina Carberry, thank you very much for joining us this morning. There's also racing in Dundalk this evening. In soccer, great drama in the Europa League last night. Manchester United through to the quarterfinals. A great goal by Paul Pogba gave them a 1-0 win at AC Milan. Elsewhere, Arsenal stumbled into the quarterfinals. They were beaten at home by Olympiacos 1-0, but they go through on aggregate. Pressure grows on Jose Mourinho. They lost to Dinamo Zagreb. Tottenham beaten 3-2 in aggregate there. Their captain Hugo Lloris described the performance as a disgrace. And Rangers were beaten 2-0 at home by Slavia Prague. 3-1 in aggregate. Rangers had two men sent off. The draw for the quarterfinals of both the Europa League and Champions League is live on RT News now at 11 a.m. today. Also live today on RT2, the opening match of the Airtricity League featuring champions Shamrock Rovers playing St Pat's. Waterford and their new manager Kevin Sheedy travelled to Drogheda, and that game can be seen on Watch LOI. The other big event of the weekend, of course, is Ireland versus England in the Six Nations tomorrow. Donal Lenihan joins us now. So, Donal, lots of changes in the Irish team. England having a mixed season, I suppose. How do you see it going?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, Des. I think, look, at the outset of the championship, we might have expected at least one of these teams to be playing for the title on the last day, but that's not the case. I mean, they're fighting for a third place finish, probably at best. England, if it was the England side that we saw at the start of the championship, then you'd fancy an Irish win. But since then, England were outstanding against France last time out, and Ireland having lost James Ryan and Gary Ringrose early in the week, to lose Will Connors to a training ground injury yesterday was a massive blow. So, you know, the pendulum seems to be swinging very much towards England, I'm afraid.
Yeah, you think those changes, there's a lot of changes, but given the squad nature, is that less disruptive than it would have been years ago?
It is, but look, you look at a player of the quality of James Ryan, especially given how good Ireland's set piece have been. The other thing I think that's been disappointing is, either by accident or design, we ended up with a back row for the last two games of Tadhg Byrne, CJ Stander back at eight, and Will Connors, who were absolutely outstanding. Now, because of injuries, none of those players feature in the positions that they were originally selected in, and CJ is the only one who's still in the back row. Tadhg Byrne gone to second row, CJ gone to six, and Jack Conan coming in at number eight. So a lot of disruption. Personally, I'd have loved to have seen Ryan Baird being backed and given an opportunity in the second row, keeping Tadhg Byrne in the back row. But I think, once again, Andy Farrell has gone with the tried and trusted.
All right, well, we'll see how it goes. And Donal is going to be part of our commentary team with Michael Corcoran on Saturday Sport tomorrow. Meanwhile, there are three games this evening in the Guinness Pro 14. Leinster play Ospreys. It's Munster versus Benetton and Ulster versus Zebre. And finally for now in golf, Shane Lowry is in a tie for ninth place going into today's round two of the Honda Classic in Florida. He's on 3 under par. The leader on 9 under is Australia's Matt Jones. Padraig Harrington finished on 2 over. And Graham McDowell, a disappointing 9 over par.
Now, for nearly 40 years, Fota Wildlife Park has been one of the visitor highlights in County Cork. It's a beautiful old estate, which is now home to big cats and giraffes and all kinds of creatures, many of them free to roam around. But a year of lockdown means there's now a question mark over Fota Park, Wildlife Park's future. And our Southern editor, Pascal Sheehy, is there this morning. It is a beautiful morning to be at Fota, Pascal. But how have the staff, and particularly the animals there, coped with a year of lockdown?
As best they can. Fota was open for the two lockdowns last year, but unfortunately, with spiralling numbers after Christmas, they were forced to close. It's a stunning morning here. Fota is a 100-acre parkland set on Fota Island in the middle of Cork Harbour, and it's absolutely teeming with wildlife here this morning. And joining me are three members of staff. Declan O'Donovan as Animal Care Manager, Catriona Scannell as senior ranger, and Sean McKeown, director of Fota Wildlife Park, has the job of keeping the show on the road. Declan O'Donovan, you first of all, can you set the scene here this morning? It's a beautiful day.
Oh, morning, yes, it's a fantastic day here. A little bit chilly, but the sun is out. You can see around us all the animals are active. We've got lemurs hanging out of the trees just to my left here, and the waterfowl are trying to pair up for coming into the breeding season.
And Catriona Scannell, you're senior ranger here. You're responsible for the primates, for the monkeys and the lemurs. Most of the animals wouldn't be conscious of the lockdown that has been here since January, but certainly the ones that you look after are. How so?
Well, I mean, this morning we've come down here and they're straight out. They're very curious, the monkeys and the lemurs here, so they want to know what's going on. And they realise that we have nothing for them, so now they're out sunning themselves in this beautiful sunshine here in the park today. So they're like that now. They will notice when people come back because they want to know what's going on. They're very curious.
And you've had two very special arrivals within the past week, waiting for the public when the public get back here.
Yes, we had great news last week. One of our female ring-tailed lemurs here gave birth to twins. So it's very, very great news for us. We haven't had ringtails in over 10 years, and they're an endangered species of lemur. So it's great for us here in the park to have this happen.
Sean McKeown, your job, I said this, to keep the show on the road here. How difficult has that been over the past 12 months?
It's been extremely difficult. We were lucky that in December last we got a grant aid of 550,000 from the government, and that has seen us through the first 3 months of this year when we've been closed. But if the restrictions continue into the summer, then that we're 95% of our income comes from visitors that come to the park. So we're totally dependent on that to actually run the park. And if we don't have them in here, then we're in trouble. And we also need the extended tourism and accommodation open and running. Otherwise, we won't be busy. Approximately 50% of our visitors during the months of June, July and August are holidaying in the area. And that brings a huge amount of income to East Cork and the Greater Cork area. And it also brings a lot of money to us as well. So without that, it makes the future of the park look very bleak.
And how real is the prospect of closure here?
Well, we have funds to keep us going till June, so we're hopeful that by then the uptick in COVID vaccines will have, you know, really taken off, and people will be able to move around a bit more, and we'll have people back in the park. What we noticed last year during the summer period, we had our busiest June ever, we had our busiest September ever, and the numbers from July and August were extremely good as well. So without foreign visitors, the domestic visitors have really helped us to keep going. So we're very dependent on that.
And your plans to reopen?
We would like to reopen in the next week to 2 weeks before the end of March, but that is just strictly as a walk-through area. So basically, it's like another park area. There's no indoor areas open. All the outdoor areas and the animals can be seen in their habitats. There's no indoor areas open at all.
And briefly, Catriona, for you and the rest of the rangers in the park, what would reopening mean?
It would mean that there'll be a buzz back in the park. There's people coming in, seeing the animals. We want to put that message across again that these, you know, we're in conservation here. So it's very important for us to put that message across to the public coming in again.
Well, if the public get mornings like this morning when Fota reopens, and hopefully that will be at the end of the month, that will indeed be a reward for all of the effort put in over the past 12 months. For the moment, from a beautiful Fota Wildlife Park here in Cork, back to you in the studio in Dublin.
Now, three students at NUI Galway have been diagnosed with COVID-19, and what's different here is it's the second time within 6 months of their initial infection. Dr. Owen McDonagh is Medical Director of Student Health at NUI Galway. He's on the line. Good morning to you. And I know you run the GP practice on campus at NUI Galway. It's for students only. So you had three positives in the autumn. If you take up the story and tell me what happened from there.
Yeah, well, I guess we had obviously the students returned to college in September, and even though a lot of the teaching was online for various reasons, maybe Wi-Fi, study space, etc., a lot of students would have returned to Galway. So understandably, with a lot of congregation and people coming into the city, we did see through the semester, last semester, cases of COVID-19. And over the full course of last semester, we would have had about 196 cases from a period from about the 1st of September to the Christmas break of the 18th of December. And then in January, we obviously had very few cases. A lot of students had remained at home because the exams in the middle of January were online. And I think we only had about 15 cases during the whole of January that the practice would have diagnosed. And then subsequently, unfortunately, obviously, as students maybe returned to Galway again, we saw a spike come in the beginning of February. And it led to the outbreak, which was obviously kind of in the national media, where we had, just as our own practice, we had 190 cases in the space of 6 weeks, with the majority of them in the space of about 5 weeks. And among those 190, there were three cases where students had been diagnosed with infection previously in September, October, November, respectively.
And they tested positive again. And were there differences this time? Is it a different variant? Is it the 117 variant this time as against a different mutation back in the autumn?
Well, all we can speak about really here from our perspective is, as a GP practice, is what we observed in terms of the outbreak, the spread of it. As I say, we had almost the same number of cases as we had in 16 weeks, in just pretty much 5 or 6 weeks this year. I think the big standout point for us as GPs was that indicated a significant difference was the rate of spread within accommodation settings, or the attack rate within any individual accommodation setting, be it an apartment or a house. With the previous outbreak that we would have seen last semester, if it got into a house of maybe five students or so, maybe two of them would get it. In this circumstance, with what we witnessed in February, when it got into a house, you know, you're talking three or four at least, if not the whole household, seemed to get infected. So it was fairly clear, and Dr. Peter Smith of the local Department of Public Health would have agreed that there was definitely a different behaviour pattern, which suggested that this was not the same virus that would have been circulating among students or in the Galway City area in the latter part of last year.
Yeah.
And this was also reflected in our positivity rate. Like, the peak positivity rate that we as a practice hit in the last semester was 33%, whereas the positivity rate peaked at almost 50% during the recent outbreak in mid-February.
And do you know at this stage how unusual it would be that you would have three people, in this case, three young people, infected, tested and all the rest of it in the autumn, being infected again?
Well, what we do know is that there was the report released by HICWA in recent weeks in relation to the period of immunity being extended, or expected immunity being extended out to around 6 months. But I guess the key thing that sometimes got lost in the detail of that report, well, two things would be that's not everyone is 100% immune for those full 6 months, that they reckon maybe about 87% of people from the studies that were done, particularly in the UK, were immune up to that 6 month period. So you're still talking about 13% who may be at risk and non-immune within the 6 months. And then also that the key thing is that the data and those studies that were done across were done, and they admitted that they cannot say that the results could be extrapolated to the new variants of concern, because it was studies that were done and data that was available up to December, and that since then that the new variants of concern have become more prevalent. So it can't be extrapolated, definitely. And I guess the key message we were trying to get out, not just to students, yeah, I guess, but to everyone, is that while it's great news that we're learning more about the immunity and that it may go on longer than we had previously thought, that it's not ultimate and absolute, and that even though we may feel that we're immune, or an individual may feel that they're immune, we're still a potential risk to the wider society, and we have to bear it as such.
A very important message. Dr. Owen McDonagh, thank you very much for joining us. 2 minutes to 9.